New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Emmy Vadnais, co-host with Jeffrey Mishlove. Our topic today is the Spiritual Emergence and Psychosis Nexus. My guest is Brian Spittles, who is an academic researcher and member of the Emergent Phenomenology Research Consortium, which aims to integrate clinical, scientific, and spiritual paradigms to improve therapeutic outcomes. His research includes consciousness studies, transpersonal psychology, psychosis, mental health recovery, quantum physics, mysticism, and indigenous knowledge and healing systems. Brian is author of Psychosis, Psychiatry, and Psycho-Spiritual Considerations, Engaging in Better Understanding the Madness and Spiritual Emergence Nexus. If you enjoy this program, please like, subscribe, press the bell icon, and share. Brian is located in Perth, Australia. Now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Brian. It's a joy to have you with me on New Thinking Aloud today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
One of the reasons that I wanted to talk with you is because you've taken a deep dive into the psychiatric literature and the history of how psychosis has become a diagnosis for people, and you suggest that when somebody has a spiritual emergence, when they become more aware of something shifting in their consciousness, that that can be indistinguishable from psychosis.
Yes, I think there are many instances in what they call spiritual emergency where they share in common what would appear to be the signs and symptoms of a psychotic episode. For example, hearing voices, visionary experiences, altered states of consciousness can occur in both what is seen as a psychotic and a psycho-spiritual perspective. And I felt that psychiatry only looked at one side of that, which was the biomedical, some touches of psychological understandings and approaches to these experiences, and didn't really have any what I'll call psycho-spiritual determinants on the table beyond some sort of cultural sensitivities that applied in certain circumstances in terms of religions and culture. But by and large, spiritual or psycho-spiritual considerations are not on the psychiatric table, and I think there's a lot to be learned from including that because it changes the whole ball game, more or less, once you start to bring that on in earnest. So that's what my task with my, which was my PhD thesis originally and then became the book, that was to unpack that systematically to leave no doubt that there is a strong case for including psycho-spiritual considerations in psychiatric practices.
Can you take us back to even the 1800s? When psychosis was brought into mainstream psychiatry?
Well, from my research, I think that happened around 1830s, 1840s, formerly 1840s. And what I did then was just, well, there's a different names that were flying around at that time for different states of psychopathology. Psychosis was coined at the time, and what I did then was track it through up until present date to have the different iterations of how it's been understood and presented. And it's a project in action. And I think I did that to show that this isn't a static set form of psychopathology, but it's shifting and changing over time within the framework of psychiatric understanding, which is okay. I mean, that is better understanding. It's provisional as they go along. They update it with new understandings, but it's maintained pretty much within the strict bounds of a biogenic understanding that this is caused by some blip in the body somewhere, probably the brain, and one day we're going to find it and prove it, which is still the case. It's not been found, it's not been proven. And in doing so, eclipses the solid investigation into other areas of the social, psychological, spiritual, which are all parts of being human. And in my view, play in what is called psychosis. But yes, it has gone through various iterations over time. And I dedicated the first part of my thesis and book to unpacking all that systematically, to not only give the reader an idea, well, be the psychiatrist or somebody else, or understanding that this is a shape-shifting thing. It still hasn't reached a place where it is a solid, proven biological entity. That's just simply not the case even today. And also in the process of doing that, to demonstrate that there is little to no inclusion of psycho-spiritual considerations within that whole trajectory. So I don't think I answered your question specifically about psychosis, but that's kind of what happens. There isn't one set thing that I can pin on. It's shape shifted over the decades or centuries.
What have you found to be a definition of psychosis? Either historically, has it maintained its definition, or has it morphed over time?
Well, I think it has morphed over time. The definitions or descriptions have changed generally. I mean, the essence of a form of psychopathology, which is seemingly incomprehensible, bizarre, disruptive, that's all in there. But the signs and symptoms have gradually changed over time for using diagnostic purposes, particularly with the DSM, or the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. But again, it's usually visionary experiences or hallucinations, as they call it in psychiatry, hearing voices, delusional beliefs, and various forms of losing your capacity to function properly. They're the key ones, but there are nuances within that, which of course all correlate directly with psycho-spiritual experiences.
Yeah. How can we discern between psycho-spiritual and psychopathological?
For me, that's a question that's still left in the air, and I deliberately labelled my or titled my PhD Better Understanding Psychosis, because I didn't aim to say this is what psychosis is. I still don't know. But it was the idea was to take what is seemed to be psychosis in a little box and say, what happens if you take away that box and just open out to other possibilities by following other stories and other ways of looking at it, then you create scope for better understanding this particular phenomenon, which is generally seen as frightening psychopathology. But once you start to unpack that, I found it very quickly went from being form of psychopathology into going into the mysteries of being human. It just went straight there. So I just kept following the leads. And that sense, I didn't start with a preconceived idea of how I'm going to unpack this. I just thought I'll let the story speak to me and I'll just keep following the leads. And that's kind of how, in that sort of iterative way, that I unpack my PhD and book. I, first of all, was of the opinion that there is a whole literature out there on differentiating psychosis from psycho-spiritual considerations. But when I started to look into it more deeply, I found that none of the criteria that had been identified by various people held water completely. For example, some people suggested that's the nature of the voices. If you have benevolent voices, that's probably a spiritual experience. If you have malevolent voices, that's probably psychosis. But I found malevolent and benevolent voices occur in both instances. And that goes on down the line. Duration of the experience is another one. If it's a long one, it's psychosis. If it's short, it's probably spiritual. Not the case. Some people go, read about in indigenous cultures can be in a state of psychosis for years before they reconcile it and they can come to terms with it and then become healers. So I didn't find one criterion that couldn't apply in both both sides of that fence, and I used a lot of examples throughout. So in the end, I came to the conclusion that you can differentiate using classic approach of the signs and presenting signs and symptoms, observable, doesn't work. At that level, you can't differentiate. Ultimately, yeah.
Mystics, shamans, spiritual leaders, saints, all of these people have experienced what can be considered psychosis.
Mm-hmm. It has been perceived that way, I think, from particularly in our culture with the sort of materialist underlying of medicine as well, where it's looked through the lens of some of the primary understandings within materialist science have been transposed into medical practice. So from that perspective, yes, it looks like psychosis, but if you look at it more from, say, a Jungian perspective or other transpersonal perspectives or shamanic perspectives, then these are just expressions of deeper states of consciousness, which are common to all human beings and all cultures. I think we've kind of lost that in our culture to a certain degree with the predominance of science. Not to say that science doesn't have its place and hasn't done wonderful things, but it's narrowed the box of what's reality, what constitutes reality, what constitutes normalcy, what constitutes psychopathology.
If somebody is severely distressed or having a hard time taking care of themselves or potentially a harm to themselves or others, of course, they would need to be getting help in that situation.
Of course. And, having been with friends who have gone through that, seen as a psychotic experience, and I know how stressful that is for the person going through it and the people around who love that person. It's not all flowers and roses and kumbaya spiritual. It takes no prisoners. So in that sense, I do agree there. But what we don't seem to have in our society is the social structure that contains that. In indigenous societies, this was seen as part of the norm. Somebody's gone off the rails, and it's sort of contained by the society. Direct family members, etc., will be there. But I found in our society, that's just not there. It's either try to deal with it at home as best you can, or hospital, which neither of those options are optimal. They have had instances where, for example, the Soteria approach, where they created a quiet environment where people would go through their processes, usually without medication, and allow it to reconcile in its own time. That was shown to be quite successful and not as stigmatizing as a hospital trip. But it just didn't get traction. It didn't get the funding, despite the fact that it showed that it worked just as well, if not better, as business as usual. So, but yes, there is a need one way or another to not only contain it, but I would say to have people on board who understand it enough to help walk that person through that experience, hopefully for an optimal outcome of some sort of transformation, which is part of the promise of a psychotic experience from the point of view of some commentators, that this is a healing gesture from the self in potential that can create positive changes in a person's life. Not absolutely, but that has that potential, and more so if you understand what it is and walk with it and help it reach its own climax, for want of a better word.
Well, it would be nice if people were not pathologized and stigmatized and told that there's something wrong with them that may actually further their experiences that are challenging for them.
A saying that I came across, which encapsulates it very nicely, is, and I've forgotten the author, but he said, what the schizophrenic drowns in, the shaman swims in. So for me, that indicated what the difference was, the absence of swimming lessons. And we don't have swimming instructors in the present psychiatric system, let alone lessons, whereas I think in shamanic cultures they did have people who were instructors and therefore could provide the lessons necessary to navigate those stormy waters, integrate it, and then come back and contain it and take it forward. So that is, I take that's easy said and done, though, if we don't have that framework of understanding. But my research showed that when that was present, people who had been in institutions for years would come out suddenly through maybe exposure to in a Maori context with people from their culture, with a healer or a leader, and suddenly find that they've become a healer themselves, and that which had put them in hospital multiple times suddenly now is the gift that they have, intensified even for healing purposes in the community. And so I come across quite a few instances of that.
So you mention a story of Egan Bedois, who was challenged with psychosis, but he was embraced by the Maori and he improved, his symptoms improved.
Yes, it was the case. He said that he had been in and out of institutions for many years, and that they had diagnosed him as incurable, treatment resistant. And it wasn't until that he linked up with a Maori elder or healer that he gradually learned to integrate it. And he said, what I'm experiencing now is by far stronger and more intense than what I had experienced before, which would have put me in hospital, but now I can contain it. It has become integral to my capacity to work as a healer amongst my people and other people as well. And he's still going today. I did some research on him just a few months ago to see who he is and where he is. And he's a practitioner and a figurehead there in New Zealand, doing good with what turned out to be the gift that he had been given for this life, but was misunderstood at first as a form of psychopathology.
You share another story of Alex, an American teenager who went to West Africa and also received great benefit from that experience with positive results.
I do remember the story. I bought the book. That's why I was so impressed by the story when I came across it that I bought the book. And it's a very interesting story, or and telling story in terms of the upheaval he went through. And I can't remember in the end what happened, whether this young man became a healer or not. I've recently tried to track down what happened, but I've forgotten, I tried to research it. But yes, he went through a whole process when he was taken to Africa and placed on that culture, on that society, rather than saying, oh, this guy's mad, said, oh, this is the markers of a healer in our culture. This person has the potential to become a healer. So I think that made a significant had a significant positive effect on his lived experience and how he sat inside his own skin. I don't know from memory whether he completely came out of it, but it certainly was a positive and beneficial experience for him to be understood and to find understanding about his own experience beyond you're mad.
Yeah. I believe he went on to Harvard University and became a healer in his own right.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find in your literature that sometimes people might experience what's considered or maybe considered psychosis? Some might consider it being not in reality. Then it begs the question, what is reality? That maybe it could be from a neurological condition, or maybe a person, of course, ingested some type of psychedelic, or maybe a person ate something or didn't get enough sleep that induced this experience for them.
Yes, I think all of those are factors, and I thought about, well, particularly, for example, sleep deprivation is a form of trance induction in some cultures, so it does shift your consciousness. It can induce hallucinatory, or what they call visions or hallucinatory experiences from a medical perspective. So definitely the ingestion of psychedelics can at a biological level work to shift your consciousness. But I still don't see consciousness in biology as being separate. That comes from the materialist understanding that physicality occurred first with the Big Bang, and over history, over time, consciousness gradually developed, and consciousness is epiphenomenal to physicality. It's almost like I've heard it described as the vapors that come out of the physical reality, and therefore is not of particular interest to medical science, because the cause isn't in the vapors, the cause is in the body and the physicality. And that's a theory. If you look at from other cultures, they see consciousness as primary and physicality as secondary. So I don't know which is true. I think quantum physics leans towards the latter. But that changes, in my view, the whole landscape of understanding these experiences. I think there's an interplay between consciousness, physicality, psychology, and they're all part of the mix. When I was sitting down, I was thinking after having read a vast body of literature from all sorts, different sorts of perspectives, I was thinking, what is a common feature here, which how I might describe what we call a psychotic experience, despite how it was precipitated, be it through stress or a brain blip or taking drugs or whatever, sleep deprivation. And it felt to me that the veil between the waking and the sleeping self peeled away, and they just fell into each other. And that in that state, you can't differentiate what is normally, sleep, dreams, dream-like experiences from normal waking-like experience. They're inseparable. They're a part of each other. And in a sense, I think that's kind of what happens. The material of the unconscious surface eclipses to a certain degree the everyday lived experience, though that hasn't disappeared either, and they merge and mix together. And later on, many months after I came to that conclusion, I found that Jung had came to the exact same conclusion 100 years before me. So he pinched my idea 100 years ago. So that's a sort of a roundabout way of answering that. I think it's a valid point, and that I also feel that it's often said that the cause, the biological causes in psychopathology, and I would argue there's biological correlates, even in terms of neurosciences, that what you're not seeing there is causal, it's correlate, it's a correlation. So anything that we do, laugh, sneeze, cry, any emotions are going to create correlatory biochemical emergence or manifestation in our brains that you can be measured and shown. That doesn't necessarily mean it's causal. But it is part of the mix, and certainly to be taken on board as a sort of diagnostic indicator, if we wanted to use it in that way, to say that it's a cause and we're going to find the cause one day, and all our money is going to go into finding the cause, and all our thinking is going into finding the cause, I don't agree with it.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Carl Jung, and there have been other figures in the history of mental health and what we're talking about here with psychosis. And one of those is Stanley Dean. And I'm wondering if you can share a little bit about Stanley Dean and his efforts with metapsychiatry in the 70s and the 80s and how he influenced what we're talking about today.
That is a very interesting question. I had not come across Stanley Dean in any of the literature. I stumbled across him by accident. He wasn't in any of the transpersonal literature with David Luckoff, etc., Stanislav Grof and all their writing on spiritual emergence and emergency. So Stanley Dean was he described himself as very much a biological psychiatrist, but he'd come across the work of Richard Buck from 100 years previously, who was the president of what is now the AP, American Psychiatric Association at the time. It was the American Medico-Psychological Association. So he was the president, and he had a spiritual emergence experience himself. So was of the, which he called cosmic consciousness, and he felt that cosmic consciousness was a very important aspect of the experience of being human, and there are instances of psychosis, manifestations of cosmic consciousness trying to come through and birth itself in mass as part of the evolutionary process of humans still in development. That didn't get traction in the day at all, but it was picked up by Stanley Dean in the 1960s, where he first coined the term metapsychiatry in the 1970s, but he called it ultra-consciousness at first, which is basically he's borrowed Buck's ideas and given it his own spin. Then he coined the term metapsychiatry, and he felt that the consideration of the, which a lot of it was ESP and psi phenomena, need to be incorporated into the framework of psychiatric understanding and treatments, because they exist. There's evidence out that these things aren't just made up. They're, at the time, CIA was researching into, and he was part of the CIA research body into psi phenomena, as was Russia, and there was a sort of race on at the time between both trying to militarize it. But so he spent over the course of 15 years, he championed the notion of metapsychiatry, and quite successfully. He had seminars which were really well attended by many psychiatrists across America, and people in Europe were very interested in his work. Wrote a book about it, had the word metapsychiatry formally introduced into the lexicon of psychiatry, so it was actually accepted in there as a key psychiatric term. And then in about 1980, he just vanished off the radar. And I've tried to track him down. I've contacted old colleagues, family members, trying to say, what happened to Stanley Dean after 1980? I saw mention of his work in some of the CIA material, so maybe he continued working with them. So my guess is, and this is just a guess, that he got to the point where he was trying to introduce notions of metapsychiatry into psychiatric training, and he was championing that at the time, and then gone. I think that was 1980. The DSM-2 went from a psychoanalytic model to the re-emergence of a biological model, or a medical model, as they called it at the time. So I think that's possibly what happened, that the rebirth of a medical model of psychiatry was at odds with Stanley Dean's notion of metapsychiatry, and it somehow got pushed off to the side. That's my guess. Mm. I'm not really sure. I've never been able to ascertain what happened to him, but his work was groundbreaking within psychiatry, and the fact that it was accepted to a large degree and then disappeared, I find interesting. It demonstrates to me the capacity for psychiatry to indeed take on board these notions and incorporate it and integrate it into its framework of operation.
Mm-hmm. And by metapsychiatry, he meant that it's including, like you said, psi phenomena. So psychic abilities, yes. Intuitive functioning, telepathy, and so forth.
Yes, all of those. Yes, and mysticism. He saw it as as the confluence between psychiatry and mysticism, mm-hmm. in sort of mystic experiences. But yes, also strongly originally on psi phenomena.
There have been some inclusions into the DSM about religious and spiritual experiences. And the history we're talking about were precursors to this. There was something called a V code. Could you share a little bit about that?
Well, the V code in DSM-4 was a result of work done by David Luckoff and others, building on the transpersonal psychology notion of spiritual emergence or spiritual emergency. David Luckoff created a framework called Mystical Experiences with Psychotic Features, which he wanted to incorporate into the diagnostic framework, because he saw that there were people who were having what appeared to be psychoses, but possibly having what is understood by Stanislav Grof as a spiritual emergence or within the transpersonal field. So he spent quite a few years gathering literature and evidence to support this and put a proposition to the task force of the DSM-IV that they include a psycho-spiritual category. And there was a bit of back and forth between the two, and in the end they decided that they would have this religious and spiritual problem category. Just before they came to the final description within the DSM-IV, Luckoff and company sent them a description that they would like included, which had mention of mystic experiences, spiritual emergence, etc. That was all pulled out. All the transpersonal material was pulled out. And what went into the DSM-IV eventually, which is a step forward, the word spiritual for the first time is entering the diagnostic Bible, as it's called. So that is a good step forward. But it was restricted to religious and spiritual values, so not experiences. And that means to this date, it's still with the DSM-5 TR in 2022, exactly the same, spiritual values. So that doesn't really enable a consideration of spiritual experiences, particularly of a transpersonal type or a mystical type or a spiritual emergence type, even though it was intended by Luckoff and others at the beginning. Interestingly, I found recently that accompanying the DSM-IV is another textbook that explains how they came to put together the various categories. And in that particular text, it does include the words spiritual emergence and spiritual emergency, but it hasn't transposed into practice. And they've still maintained the values-based approach in the DSM up to present date, which is limited and limiting. It's very sort of a mainstream perspective of spiritual experiences, but it doesn't extend into the notion of spiritual emergence or spiritual awakenings or kundalini or any of that stuff. It doesn't have scope for doing so. I think there's room for change there still. And Luckoff have tried since then to get it updated, but it's been ignored or sidestepped or whatever.
What is a psychiatrist or mental health professional to do with that inclusion of that religious and spiritual values when they're working with a client? How can that assist them? Because the very fact that it's in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Health Disorders, which is the Bible of what these practitioners use to diagnose people, it implies that there's a psychopathology there versus drawing upon somebody's strengths, for example.
There's two answers to that, and it goes in two directions. One is I felt it gives limited capacity for the consideration of spiritual values or spiritual factors. I think that also depends on the psychiatrist. There are some psychiatrists who are really open to the notion of spiritual emergence or spiritual emergency or spiritual experiences beyond just values. So that's one answer. So I think each individual will take that according to their own framework of beliefs. Something that I've noticed in the back of those, it's been gradually building up over the years, but they have what's called the cultural formulation interview in the DSM-5, more so even so in the DSM-5 TR, where they mention in DSM-5, for the first time, they mention the word spirituality rather than just spiritual. So that, for me, that denotes some sort of shift in thinking. And in the CFI, or cultural formulation interview, it does have the capacity for clinicians to ask patients about their spiritual experiences. What do you think caused this? What treatment modalities have you pursued in the past? And this, I think, is at odds with the religious and spiritual problem category, because that's focused purely and locked in on values. They have this other framework that clinicians can use, which allows you, the clinicians, to inquire about religious and spiritual experiences and how you might perceive treatment modalities that work best for you. Though they still don't use the word spiritual emergence, I think it has scope open to that. So I see that as a positive step forward. They're still cloistered a bit in terms of that. The other answer to the quest, to the question, is that I find it very interesting that medical psychiatry does acknowledge and recognize the reality of religious and spiritual experiences and cultural experiences, and they bring that centrally to their diagnostic practice, where say, okay, we have a person here who's seemingly psychotic. First of all, we need to check, do they, or are they aligned with a culture or a religion whereby hearing voices is part of that particular practice? And if so, this is possibly not psychosis. It's probably just a normal experience within that cultural or religious framework, which is good. But what it doesn't ask is, if, for example, someone's hearing spirits, what are those spirits, and do spirits exist? And how can it be psychopathological for somebody, or non-psychopathological for somebody who's in a sort of cultural or religious setting, but psychopathological for someone else who isn't in particularly in one of those settings? Is it a generic human experience? That question's not asked. Can it apply across the board to any human being? If so, what are these spirits? And that's why I went into that in my book, What Are These Spirits? Because once you ask that question and start digging, it brings in a very big answer. And it shows that there is something beyond this, because it may, beyond just saying, well, culture, you know, sort of cultural considerations without any deeper digging into it from a psychiatric perspective.
What did you find was the answer to spirits?
I didn't find an answer. Ultimately, I found a lot of different answers, which was very interesting. I'm happy to not have an answer, because I think a lot of those things are often beyond our cognition and our capacity to pin them down. They go on infinitely. But what I found generally, though, there's two different views. They're from maybe from a Indigenous perspective and other perspectives, that spirits have their own ontology. They exist like we do, but not embodied. So that was one point of view, from a Tibetan Buddhist perspective, and maybe a Jungian point of view, that they, spirits don't exist ontologically. They don't have their own ontology, but they are reflections or manifested aspects of our own deeper psyche, however you want to understand that. Jung was in the middle, wrestling both ways. From a Tibetan Buddhist perspective, they said, well, regardless of their ontological reality, they have powerful effects on individuals, and they have very real effects. So it doesn't matter how you understand it. To look deeper into that gives you a deeper capacity to help people negotiate and navigate those experiences when they occur, which doesn't exist in mainstream medical psychiatry, but is integral to, say, Tibetan Buddhist psychiatry and their understanding of demons and etc.
It's also integral to a lot of religions and spiritual practices around the world.
It is indeed. It's, well, how would I put this? I think if you look, created a circle, this is just a thought experiment I have myself, and you had to draw like a little pie chart as to the amount of people over the history of humanity that believed in spirits and those that didn't, you would probably find, just with the advent of medical science and sciences, there'd be a little thin pencil line of those who didn't believe in the existence of spirits because it doesn't fit within the theories of materialism. And all the rest is people who have done and still do believe that spirits exist. I mean, that doesn't prove it, but it gives a sense that if people have believed this for so long, for millennia, and have worked on these frameworks and healing capacities successfully, and have experiences of communicating beyond the veil of just the physical world, then how can you just dismiss it out of hand as not being real? At least ask, you know, maybe this is real. Can we look further into this? If it's that prolific, what's this about? Rather than just say, nah, doesn't exist.
Right. That's consistent with the inclusion of the religious and spiritual values in the DSM, because people value spirits and spirituality, a majority of people, based on what you're saying, do.
Well, I do, and I think it was a good productive step forward to have that there. Though, and I think from memory that it did in a religious context, it did include religious experiences, but not spiritual. It was just values. I think from memory, which, considering the original definition or description that Luckoff and Parton and crew delivered as what they wanted in the, and seeing what was stripped out.
Yeah.
Tells a story. Well, it doesn't tell the details of the story, but it tells that the story happened in one form or another in it, that was edited out. So no, that doesn't go in the manual and still hasn't made it in there. But spiritual considerations, and there is development over time, particularly in terms of cultural contexts, that has developed since DSM-4 quite strongly.
Can we go back to Stanislav Grof and Christina Grof, who coined the term spiritual emergencies and really felt that it was necessary to differentiate that from a person being diagnosed or pathologized for their experiences?
Yes, that came out of the crucible of humanistic psychology at first, and from humanistic psychology, and Grof was a core member of a group of people who felt that there is a fourth dimension of psychology, and that's transpersonal psychology. It had three iterations of psychology to that date. I think there was a behaviorist, psychoanalytic, humanist, and then they proposed transpersonal psychology. So it was in that, and they came to that understanding because they felt there was a spiritual dimension, which other iterations of psychology had not taken into account. So transpersonal psychology was going to do that job. And the notion of spiritual emergence through Grof was born in there. The exact pathway of how that came to be, I don't know. But the instance where it was first mentioned in the text was that Christina Grof had gone through an experience which was seemingly psychotic or psychotic-like at face value, but he described it as a spiritual emergence. And then the term stuck from there on in. That was in around the early 1970s, I think, that he first used that notion. Then he developed it beyond that with frameworks for differential diagnosis. From a psychiatric perspective and from a spiritual emergence perspective. So, because Grof was a psychiatrist, so he wanted to bring those worlds together and integrate that into mainstream psychiatric practice so that people were not misdiagnosed and therefore, mistreated, so to speak.
Yeah. Some of the types of spiritual emergencies by the Grofs are shamanic crisis, awakening of Kundalini, episodes of unitive consciousness or peak experiences, sometimes known as a mystical experience, crisis of psychic opening, past life experience, communication with spirit guides and channeling, near-death experiences, close encounters with UFOs and alien abduction experiences, and possession states, which really seems to encompass a lot of the field of parapsychology.
It does indeed. It's a broad spectrum of non-ordinary experiences or states of consciousness that pretty much pathologize in the mainstream if you admit to put your hand up for any of those. Just don't say it in a clinical setting. Whereas, personally, I know many people who have psychic experiences and some struggling with them, others integrating them and have integrated them and taking them out to the world in one practice in one form or another. So to me, those sorts of experiences are not abnormal. I just think they're part of the full spectrum of being human, and capacities which were nurtured in other traditions and other cultures and accepted, whereas in our present society they're seen as all a bit odd and suspicious and maybe a bit mad. And I think Grof tried to undo that and discern pure psychopathology from something that looks like it but isn't it.
I like that word integration because it also applies to not only psychotic states, but when somebody maybe experiences great loss trauma, transformation. They can have great stress, anxiety, depression, a dark night of the soul. And I believe you share a story of a person suggesting that sometimes these experiences can take years to integrate.
Well, they can. I don't remember the story of the person in particular, but I had come across it in a description of that from an early anthropological article. An anthropologist noticed that somebody had, you'd be in the hut, you'd be hopping around like a frog, singing out loud, jumping in the fire, people pulling him out, and then go hopping off into the night, singing and jumping and crying, and that people had to look after this person for two or three years before he finally integrated it and became a healer in the society. So 6 months and you get a diagnosis of schizophrenia. So in our particular framework of understanding. So there have been instances of that I've come across. I was just now been reading an article on the interface between bipolar disorder and states of spiritual emergence experiences. And the person there, the practitioner who's worked with various people, found that there are stages of integration and that what is really important, the space is created for that integration to take place, and that people that would normally swing back and forth between these states of mania and depression, if we're able to integrate it with assistance from somebody else who understood the notion of integration, would experience quite profound shifts in their life where what used to be manic would be illuminating and the depression would just gradually subside. And so there were instances, through three case studies whereby that had happened in her experience as a transpersonal therapist and a clinician. So I think the notion of integration, as you pointed out, is integral to this. So a lot of these experiences are big, and we, like anything that's big, it can be overwhelming at first, and until such times that we can systematically incorporate that into our framework of being and understanding, it can be overwhelming to the point of breakdown and malfunction. And I think it doesn't help, on top of that, to have the whole thing stigmatized and locked in place to a certain degree with medications, even though for some instances medications is the only thing we have. And I have seen instances where people are sort of right out there and possibly a danger to themselves in one way or another, and then within days of medication brought right down and think, well, didn't want to go there, but it worked. So to a certain degree, but if you look beyond that in terms of was this person going through an experience that needed to erupt and then incorporate, I don't know. And did we have the framework just to contain and work with that? No, there was no framework for that. So hospital is often the only other place to go. And, you know, people, I found the people, clinicians in hospital, are very nice people, and they care about people by and large. They're there for the right reasons. So it's not to demonize psychiatrists and people who work in psychiatric settings. I found them to be mostly really nice people.
Right, and that might be what a person needs. However, you're suggesting that we can address these phenomena with people with more breadth, with a broader scope, a larger framework to assist them perhaps with their own development of themselves as a being, as a spirit, as a human.
Yes, I use the term, which I borrowed from somewhere, I can't remember, but technologies of consciousness, which I think was fitted very nicely, that people who adept in technologies of consciousness, who are trained in that and know how to navigate those landscapes, can then help other people walk through those landscapes. But if you don't have those skills, you're basically, you know, have the blind leading the lost. So it doesn't work. And I know that's a big ask to suggest that clinicians, when going through training, learn technologies of consciousness. I mean, this could be through meditative practices and other practices. But I think the more that a person has an understanding of that landscape, the inner landscapes of the self, the more likely they are to pathologize, to try to lock it in a box, rather than just be open to the experience unfolding and let it, you know, to a certain degree, guide people through a process of integration, which, again, you can't make integration happen. You can set up an optimal landscape for it or circumstances for it to hopefully occur. But that's one of the things I suggest in my book, is that in terms of the ramifications of all this research to the practice of psychiatry, one of them is that ideally practitioners need, to some degree, be versed in technologies of consciousness, either in practice and or in understanding and theory.
Right. What other suggestions do you have based on your deep dive into the history of this that would help bring a broader scope to help more people with these processes?
I think what helps, and this I tried to emulate this myself in my research process, which is what I call an open-ended, heuristic, phenomenological approach, rather than start with, I mean, I did that deliberately, because when you're writing a PhD, you're supposed to have a methodology. So I thought, well, I have to find a way, a sneaky way to get around that, because I don't want to be hemmed in by anybody's methodologies. I want the story to speak to me and I'll follow it. I want it to be open-ended. I don't know where it's going to take me, but I want to give it that scope. So I created a heuristic approach, which enabled me to do that as a methodology.
And can you briefly share with people what heuristic means?
Well, from my understanding of heuristic, it is an open-ended approach which enables researchers to go beyond the bounds of set modalities of understanding, so it creates space for deeper phenomenological investigation. Because if you have a preconceived idea of what constitutes a particular reality, then you tend not to look beyond it, outside that box. And I just felt, well, I want all the boxes open. I don't know where this is going to lead. I don't know, and I don't expect to ever arrive at a place that's going to say this is what psychosis is. But it certainly, as you can see from the evidence in my book, it opens up a lot of ways in which you can understand it beyond standard way that it is understood in our society, both in a clinical setting and in the mainstream. There is a vast array of ways in which this can be looked at. And I found even just within clinical settings, to have an open-minded, open-ended approach to what's happening for a person, can elicit stories that and experiences that won't come out if people think they're going to be diagnosed and pathologized. They just keep their mouth shut. And it's quite common. I was at a conference once, and one of the speakers there, it was a hearing voices conference, and most of the audience hear voices. There were some clinicians there. And he said, okay, everybody here, those who have lied to the psychiatrist, please put your hand up. All hands go up. He said, see, we have a practice here that teaches you to lie about your experience in a clinical setting. This is not right. This doesn't work. So I found, and just in my own experience, when I was at one point training in transpersonal counseling, and how I was working with a young woman who was suicidal. It was my first client, so to speak. I thought, you know, throw me in the deep end. And she had, you know, pulling her hair, so she was half bald through just not being able to control that, with obviously, you know, deep traumas in there. I don't know what they were. But I found through the process of, rather than just sitting down and giving that a name or a label, we just chatted back and forth. And it kind of, and to a certain degree, I was flying by the seat of my pants. I was thinking, I'm making it up as I go along here. But after I got past that fear, a sort of dynamic occurred between us, where we ended up following just street leads and stories that took her down under the floorboards. Something was down under the floorboards, which this is speaking in metaphorical terms, but it was a metaphorical explanation as to what was underlying what was happening for her. We never got to she was too scared to go down and look. And in the next session, we'll go look there. But she got up and said that I have seen dozens of psychologists and psychiatrists, and none of them have gone anywhere near where we just went today. All I basically did was follow the story. I phenomenologically follow my own intuition, followed the story. It was scary to do that because what happens to me? I dried up, didn't have any more ideas. But I found that took us together to places that we wouldn't have gone otherwise. So from my own lived experience, I found approaching people when they're going through whatever form of suffering to adopt that approach allows the space for stories to be told and for people to open up. And for something of a healing, just in that, even though it doesn't take away the whole problem, it creates a different space and different opportunities. So in technical terms, that's called a phenomenological approach. But that, I think, is to incorporate that into clinical settings makes a difference. It's less likely to make a person feel like they're an object of classification, this stigmatized object of classification, that they're a person with a lived having an experience, which is scary and horrible and frightening and illuminating and all this stuff. I don't need to be labeled on top of it all. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, you treated her like a person and you were able to have a conversation heart to heart.
Yes, and that's not just with people going through what would be seen as psychiatric instances, but people going through everyday problems, out there on the streets, which we tend not to share our problems, but I find if we sit down and start chatting with people and just follow that approach, just bouncing off each other, next thing you know, you're into private stuff and personal stuff, and it creates a sense of resonance and a sense of intimacy, which otherwise isn't there. If you're just chit-chatting about safe things, things that are okay to say, I think we, it's not to say that we should go out and spill our guts to everybody about our problems, but I find approaching people in that fashion opens the possibility of, if they want to go there, I'm quite happy to go there, including with, I work as a tutor and working with students. So I'll often say, technically speaking, my job is to tutor you in skills in terms of your academic performance at university. But if your lived experience is getting in the way of you being able to function at university, then I'm happy to go there if you want to talk about it. If you don't, that's fine. I respect that. But I've found some people have opened up stories that have had me in tears, thinking, oh, wow, no wonder you can't function properly. How did you survive that? But just to get the story out, suddenly they'll get past a hurdle where otherwise they might have just given up and left because they couldn't, it was too much.
Mm-hmm.
And that's trauma that was unresolved and affecting their capacity to function as a student. So it doesn't just apply to clinical settings, but I find across the board with each other on the bus, wherever.
Right. You're able to see the person beyond labels, perhaps.
To the degree, the best degree that we can. I have my limitations too, my judgments, as we all do. But yes, I try to find when I'm, especially meeting new people, I kind of enjoy the challenge of meeting a new person over a cup of tea or a coffee at the cafe and chat. And next thing you know, 2 hours later, you're going, oh, wow, we should do that again. And again, when I approach that, I do it as a phenomenological. I just go in there with a blank slate and go, okay, I don't know what we're going to talk about, but we'll find out when we get there.
Yeah. Just like this interview.
To a certain degree, yes. Yes.
Why is this topic so important to you?
That's a good question. I have tried to dig back. This came out in the 1980s somewhere when I was traveling around, hitchhiking around the world. I shifted from a mainstream working class background into hitchhiking, traveling, became a hippie for a while, running around with long hair and dreadlocks. Somewhere in all that, when I started reading about Native American traditions, I think it was that I was very interested in Native American Indigenous cultures. Before I became interested in Australian Indigenous cultures. But in that, there, somewhere in that mix in the 1980s, that's where this was born. In the 1990s, when I was doing the transpersonal counselling courses and shamanic study courses with a Dr. Ralph Locke, he said, do you want to co-write a book with me about spiritual emergence type experiences? That is a response to the DSM, but we're written in a transpersonal context. And we never did finish it. And I think that's when in about 2010, when I thought, oh, well, I've done my undergrad and my master's, I might as well do a PhD. And I thought, oh, well, I'll do it on that, because we didn't finish the project. So I'll see. So that's how it came into being, basically. But I can't pinpoint exactly where that started. It might have been just buried in my psyche from way back, because I went pretty much from a strong drinking, partying culture when I'm in my early 20s, and had and suddenly this very distressing emotions welled up from I don't know where, and I didn't know what they were, but that was the start of my spiritual journey from then, which my friends thought was immensely amusing, and I got bagged for being weird, but that was part of friendship. But I haven't stopped since then, since my early 20s to now, that journey has continued in deepening my understanding of spiritual matters and the interface of that with the physical lived world that we're all in.
Well, I'm grateful that you followed that. Is there anything else you want to share today about the spiritual emergence and psychosis nexus?
I would. What I would like to do, I think, is acknowledge the fact that my book wouldn't be published, and I've got it here, so I might as well show it since we'll be talking about it. So there's a little story behind that, if I may, and then this is in forms of acknowledgement, is that I tried to get my PhD published after it was accepted, and it was picked up by a book publisher, and after 18 months of back and forth, I finally found, well, they keep changing the staff and everybody's telling me they want different things. And in the end, I said, you know, thanks, but no thanks, and left on good terms. I said, I'm not going to publish a book. It's too hard. I'm going to write it as journal articles. And I started that process. As I was doing that, synchronistically, I got a Facebook message from someone saying, this might interest you, Brian, the Emergent Phenomenology Research Consortium. So I looked it up and thought, oh, wow, that's right in line with what I just did my PhD on. So I contacted one of the originators of that, Dr. Daniel Ingram, sent him a copy of my PhD, said, look, this is the work I've done. He got back to me, and I subsequently have become a member of EPRC, or the Emergent Phenomenology Research Consortium, which is a sort of global network of people with lived experience and researchers. And unbeknownst to me, he was so impressed by my PhD that he sent it to a publisher friend in the UK of AM Books, who contacted me and said, do you want to publish your book? Well, this is a book. And I said, oh, yeah, yeah. And I said, do you need it edited? And he goes, no, I like it as it is. You can pretty much publish it as it is. Maybe cut the word count down a bit, but which I did. Whereas the other ones, you know, you got to cut this out and cut that out and do this and do that and include. So I just pretty much, that's how it happened. So had it not been for Daniel's intervention, my book wouldn't be there. So thank you, Daniel. I need to say that. Where to beyond this? This is what's happening beyond this. I've also just recently been asked to be part of a docu-series, which just to make sure I get the title right, Breaking Down, Breaking Open, Breaking Through. So they're putting together a docu-series interviewing people with lived experience and people like myself with other experience and knowledge to highlight this particular interface between psychopathology and psycho-spiritual experiences. So, yes, what I did with my PhD is what I'm doing with how this develops. I'm following the leads and see where it takes me.
Yeah, beautiful. Daniel has been a guest on New Thinking Aloud. I actually got to interview him, and we talked about the EPRC, and I'll link to that interview in the upper right corner of the screen. Brian, based on your experience with taking a very thorough investigation on the history of these topics in psychiatry, do you have any impressions of where we're headed now with this topic, with how spirituality is being addressed within the mental health profession?
I see a parallel with what's happening there at that space and what's happening in the world at large that there's a sort of dynamic tension between the materialist worldview and which, you know, and the ways that manifests in terms of separating ourselves from nature and seeing nature as something that we can use endlessly. Trying to bring those together, there's a there seems to be a dynamic tension, not only at a global level, but at that interface in psychiatry. There are some psychiatrists pushing for us that we need to incorporate spiritual considerations. We are spiritual beings. That's part of our reality. Same dynamic, we need to have spiritual considerations in terms of our relationship with nature, with other human beings, with the planet as a whole. So I see those not as separate. I think that's going to be quite a tumultuous struggle. And which way it pans out, I don't know. But I did see promise in what, as I pointed out earlier, in the what they call the CFI and the DSM, the cultural formulation interview. It's had its language in there and pathways that can lead towards the incorporation of spirituality in psychiatry. Whether or not that happens, I don't know. I think there's a really strong biomedical trend in psychiatry, supported very much by the pharmaceutical industry, which makes lots of profits from particularly having that model in place. So whether or not that shifts, I think it's watch this space. I would like to see it shift because I think the present model of psychiatry, despite good intentions, does more harm than good, unintentionally, but that's the way it pans out for a lot of people. If, for example, somebody going through a spiritual emergence or a spiritual awakening experiences need for that to reach its own climax and integration. If it's locked down, locked in place with medications, hospitalization, stigmatization, that is perpetuating the state of psychopathology rather than healing it. So, and if that, I'm not saying that happens in every instance, but if it's happening 1 in 10 even or less, that's damaging, and I think it's incumbent upon us to step back and change the paradigms of understanding and the frameworks in which we operate, if that even exists in terms of medical ethics. Even if that's on the table as a possibility, you must step back then and say, well, how do we tell the difference? If we accept that this happens, how do we tell the difference? If we don't know how to tell the difference, how are we going to operate with business as usual? I think those questions have to all be teased out. What does this mean in terms of pharmaceutical profits? What does it mean in terms of the years we're put in studying this from a particular paradigm of understanding? And now we have to undo all that which we've invested ourselves in. There's a lot of curly questions in there. So I don't know how it's going to play out, but I know which way I'd like it to go.
Yes, and each person is individual with what they need, and may everybody get the support they need. And Brian, thank you so much for helping raise awareness about these topics that more of us really need to understand better so we can all support and love each other, really.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me here today too. It's not only to share my book and share what I've learnt on the process of understanding, but also to give me the opportunity to frighten myself and come out and speak in this in a public forum, which is not my happy place normally, but I'm very thankful that you created this space for me.
Well, we're so grateful you joined us. Thank you for being with me, Brian. And for those of you listening or watching, thank you for being with us. You are the reason that we are here.
I imagine that by now, many of you already realize that, in conjunction with White Crow Books, we've just launched the new Thinking Aloud Dialogues book imprint, and our first title is There Life After Death?